listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, Ellie MacArthur, Dinah Jansen, Aaron McCulley, and Zane Mungle. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. It's been a landmark year for Kingston's Great Lakes Museum, from celebrating its 50th anniversary to winning Ship of the Year for the SS Keewatin, and now being named Ontario's Choice for Top Small Museum, Art Gallery, or Historic Site. The recognition comes from Attractions Ontario, chosen by public vote across the province. For the museum, it's yet another milestone in a year already packed with achievement. The museum's executive director, Beth Shippers, spoke with CFRC about this latest accomplishment.
We are thrilled. We are delighted. It is an honor for us to have received this award, yet another award, and it speaks volumes to the community that supports us. The staff and volunteer team have worked tirelessly to become a museum that could win an award like this.
Behind the accolades lies hundreds of hours of painstaking work, from restoring ship rooms and opening new areas to curating fresh exhibits. The museum has also been looking for creative ways to bring in new guests.
We also hosted a clay and glass art exhibit. It's called From Fusion, which is the Ontario Clay and Glass Association. We hosted that for about 2 months over the summer, which is definitely different. The theme of the exhibit was water, and it was specifically designed so that people would think of us while they were creating their artwork. So we hosted that in the museum, which I think goes a long way for kind of connecting communities that wouldn't normally be connected, the art scene with the historic maritime scene. We're very interested in working with other communities outside of museums and other museums here in the city.
The Great Lakes Museum works closely with its neighbors, whether sharing events or celebrating milestones together.
One thing that's interesting about Kingston, because I'm sure you know this, that it's the museum capital of Canada because there's so many of us here. We work really closely together, and often you will see when there's an event happening at one museum, all the other museums are coming as well and supporting and having booths. So just this past, earlier this month, we had our 50th anniversary celebration, and we had other museums in the city coming, and they had booths and they were sharing their stories with the people that were coming to our museum. And we do that a lot around Kingston.
And province-wide, the win carries extra weight.
There's probably just over 700 museums, art galleries, and historic sites in Ontario. So there's a lot. Most of them are small museums like us. There is obviously the large ones like the ROM and the Canadian Museum of Nature, but most of them are small. And that's a surprising number. Because there is over 700 museums and art galleries and historic sites in Ontario, it makes it really special that we were chosen for this award.
This has been a year of growth for the museum.
In 2023, so just 2 years ago, this museum saw about 8,000 people in the entire year. In 2024, this museum welcomed just over 27,000 people. And this year, in 2025, we've already welcomed 26,000 people, and it's not even the end of September. So we feel like we're really helping bring people to Kingston. And also, we've added something new to the city. There is finally, like, people who live here are starting to see that we're a place to come visit as well.
So what's next? The SS Keewatin remains open for tours until November, including evening haunted walks. Winter will bring the Nautical Nights lecture series and film screenings, while staff and volunteers plan for the next stage of growth. For the Great Lakes Museum, Ontario's choice is more than a title. It's 50 years of history and a future that looks brighter than ever. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Henry Walker with your campus news for this week.
This is Henry Walker with CFRC's Campus Beat, bringing you the latest in Queen's campus news. On September 26th, members of the Queen's Branch of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, SPHR, held a sit-in at the John Deutsch University Center, the JDUC, calling on both student governments, the AMS and SGPS, to take a clear stance on student demands for divestment. The sit-in focused on three key actions: full disclosure of all AMS and SGPS financial investments, divestment from companies that SPHR says are complicit in Israeli military operations, and holding a student vote on the issue during upcoming general assemblies.
The main goals of today, in both that they apply to both of the student unions, is that they disclose all of their investments.
At the center of this campaign is a push to endorse QUAD. That's the Queen's University Apartheid Divestment Initiative. QUAD has published a list of companies, including Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Elbit Systems, which it says supply weapons used in ongoing violence in Gaza.
We're pushing the university to divest from those companies. This is not new. This is just the latest iteration.
SPHR members describe financial ties on the part of the university to those corporations as unacceptable, especially in the context of what they and the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry have referred to as an ongoing genocide in Gaza.
There's no such thing as a neutral stance when it comes to genocide. Queens cannot claim neutrality while its investments arm one side of...
The sit-in included speeches, student outreach, and discussion with members of the AMS executive, who met with the group inside the JDUC.
We're here today to try and encourage both of our student governments to endorse student activism.
At one point, campus security warned SPHR members that they were trespassing and threatened to call Kingston police. But when they returned, the AMS president reportedly asked them to leave, at which point they did and did not make a future reappearance. Beyond the question of divestment, SPHR also emphasized a broader goal, making Queens a place where students feel safe and supported in joining and organizing Palestinian solidarity efforts on campus. They say that while support for Palestine is high among undergrads, many students are hesitant to get involved out of fears of institutional or social backlash. SPHR says this movement is long-standing, part of a wider cross-campus divestment campaign that's existed for over a decade at Queen's and other universities across North America. In other news, Queen's has recently announced plans to reopen Bader College next year in 2026 after the past multi-year closure due to major structural concerns at Hurstmonceux Castle. The college was shut down in 2023 when engineers identified safety risks in the gatehouse and other parts of the historic building. Repairs are now set to wrap up by the end of this year. When it reopens, Bader College will offer a revamped academic model, as stated by the university, focusing on immersive international learning, research residencies, and sustainable campus practices, including a large-scale rewilding of the estate grounds. For CFRC's Campus Beat, I'm Henry Walker. Stay tuned for more Queen's Campus News.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk with your sports report. The Queens Gaels hosted the York Lions at Richardson Stadium on Saturday afternoon. Despite missing the services of their star inside linebacker Justin Pace and their head coach Steve Snyder, both serving one-game disciplinary suspensions, the Gaels did not miss a step against the Lions as they came out of the gates hot, putting up 12 points in the first quarter. The game's first touchdown came on this short catch turned long run from number two, Russell Weir.
Russell Weir slicing and dicing through the York defense! Russell Weir, he is over the 50, the 40, the 30, he gets a block, he cuts it back, see ya, touchdown, Queens!
That was the first of four touchdowns for quarterback number 12, Alex Vraken. He also connected with his favorite target, number 16, Nathan Falcone, on this long bomb just before the end of the first half.
Airing one out to Nathan Falcone. Caught by Nathan Falcone. See ya! Touchdown, Queens! Nathan Falcone on a beautiful ball from Alex Vrankin.
Queens would tally an interception on York's final drive of the half, setting up a Cedric Smith touchdown, giving them a huge lead at halftime. The Gales offense, simply put on a clinic. Alex Vrankin threw for a career-high 394 yards and four touchdowns. Star running back number 29, Jared Kasari, also scored two long rushing touchdowns, giving him 22 on his Queens career. Defensively, the Gales harassed, harangued, hurried, and hit York's star QB, Keegan Hall. Number 52, Ollie Jackson, tallied a career-high four sacks on Saturday, and that pass rush helped number 24, Ashton Miller-Melançon, pick up interception number 15 for his Queens career on this play.
Hall dropping back to pass, throwing this one up, picked off, Ashton Miller-Melançon, interception number 15 for Queens number 24. Great play there from the mastermind. Not who you want to throw a jump ball against.
The Gales prevailed 57-5 over the York Lions. Queens will be on the road next week in Guelph to take on the Griffins in Guelph's homecoming game. A win for the Gales books a playoff spot. Queens will have a bye week after the Guelph game and play their final regular season contest on October 18th, a homecoming clash with the Windsor Lancers. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the week. We begin with Monday, September 29th. Beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. 22 degrees, feeling like 22 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 13 overnight. Tuesday, September 30th, another 22 degree day. Not a cloud in the sky, a beautiful sunny day, dropping down to a chilly 7 overnight. Wednesday, October 1st, daytime high of 17, overnight low of 7, but otherwise sunny and beautiful. Thursday, October 2nd, 16 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 9 overnight. Friday, October 3rd, 18 degrees is your daytime high, a beautiful sunny day, and that continues into the weekend, a very bright start to October. Saturday, October 4th, 19 degrees, feeling closer to 20, a perfect day to catch the Queens Gales versus Guelph Griffins football game. And Sunday, October 5th, 20 degrees with plenty of sunshine and overnight low of 14. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. We'll begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Bagot Street, Johnson 2 William is closed October 2nd from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. for Utilities Kingston to complete a service repair. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl Street, Collingwood 2 Toronto closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Innovation Drive, Highway 15 to Discovery is closed September 30th from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. for paving operations. Johnson Street at Victoria closed until October 24th for sewer separation and road rehabilitation. Lincoln Drive at Bay Ridge closed until October 10th for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Sydenham Street, Princess 2 Queen, closed until October 24th for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Tivoli Avenue, Midland 2 Sierra, closed September 29th to October 17th for the installation of new services. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Cataractway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main. Gardeners Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2 to Abbeydon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Ave, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Ave. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, limestone to Jasper. Expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and some road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage. Trudell Road, development to Danbury. Expect delays while a contractor completes road and sidewalk improvements. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while the contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water mains, sidewalks, and road.
Hello, I'm Ellie MacArthur, a CFRC intern from Queen's Department of History, and it's time for a concerts and events calendar for this week. Starting with concerts, on Monday, head to the RCHA to catch Joe Policastro Trio from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. Kingston local Julia Finnegan continues her residency at the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. Reservations are preferred and can be booked by calling or emailing. Also on Monday, the Morning Doves play Musiki from 8 to 11 p.m. for free. On Tuesday, Musiki's weekly open mic takes place from 7 to 11 p.m. And catch Tuesdays with Eric and Megan, folk fiddle and guitar duo, at the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. On Wednesday, hop on a ferry and head over to Hotel Wolf Island for open mic night from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. Catch Peter Dreams with special guest Moon River at the Broom Factory beginning at 7:30 p.m. Tickets can be purchased online from $33. Frank Ryan plays his soulful songwriting from 8 to 11 p.m. at Musiki on Wednesday. And alternative country Irish fusion is Johnny Kirkwin's game. Catch his set at Timeout Bar and Bistro at 6 p.m. This all-ages event is free. On Thursday at the Toucan, Queen's bands Doghouse, Sleep on the Couch, and Last Call hit the stage from 9:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. It's always a good night when there's no cover, so stop by at any time. Death from Above 1979 plays at the Ale House from 7:30 to 10 p.m. Tickets can be purchased through the Ale House or on artist's website and social media. For a night of country, Alexa Goldie, Bradley Hale, and Abby Stewart play Stages Nightclub from 6 to 10 p.m. Tickets can be purchased through Alexa Goldie's platforms from $40 to $51. Down to catch the ferry? Clear Breeze is an instrumental groove-oriented jazz, bossa nova, and more at Hotel Wolf Island from 6 to 9 p.m. And this event is free. Melissa Bedard sings both French and English at Le Sesame Theater at 7 p.m. Tickets can be purchased for $15 to $45 online. And on Friday, at Academy Food and Drink, jazz duo Dave Beckstead and Natalie Cran play a free set from 5 to 8 p.m. The Broom Factory hosts Pierre Bensouzan, French-Algerian acoustic guitar virtuoso, vocalist, and composer. Doors open at 7:30, and tickets can be purchased through KKP Concerts at $35 each. At 5 to 8 p.m., Matt Dickinson's Rock and Roll Marathon Man features hits from the 60s, 70s, and 80s at the Cove Inn. Hop on the ferry and head to Hotel Wolf Island to catch the Oscar Evans Quartet for free from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Also at the hotel, from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m., Duro Crew DJs Get Groovy for just $15. Oakridge Ave, local Kingston band, plays at the Isabel Bader Center from 8 to 10 p.m. Tickets are $25 and can be bought in person or on the Isabel's website. The mansion hosts Lookout I'm Free Tour with the Lookout Service, Freddie Freeloader, and supported by Kyra Johnson. Tickets are $18 and the show runs from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. Hysteria, Montreal Def Leppard tribute, plays from 8 to 11:30 p.m. at Overtime Sports Bar. This is a 19-plus event, and tickets can be purchased through Kingston Live, the artists and venue social media, at just $23. Quite the lineup this week at the Broom Factory. On Saturday, Bridge City Sinners, Dead on a Sunday, and Joshua Quimby play at 6:30 p.m. for $35. For big energy and sound, come see Big Fat Horn Band at the RCHA. This month's special guest is Vanessa Head. Physical tickets can be purchased at the club. In the mood for some country? The Buckle hosts Rudy and the Saddle Ups for free on Saturday. So put on your boots, grab a dance partner, and head to the show at 9 p.m. At the Hotel Wolf Island, Kingston favorites Evan Jackson, as well as Run Coyote and Poplar, play from 8:30 to 10:30 p.m. The Kingston Grand Theater puts on We Walk the Line, a tribute to Johnny Cash, featuring Ward Cornforth. Ward incorporates historical accounts and personal anecdotes for the show. It begins at 7:30 p.m., and tickets can be found on the Kingston Grand Theater website for $66. On Sunday, hit Time Out Bar and Bistro as Texas Tuxedo Country Rock Band hit the stage from 4 to 6:30 p.m. with no cover. Then stick around for open mic with Steve G beginning at 7 p.m. At Musiki, catch Mr. Christie's acoustic set from 8 to 11 p.m., also for free. Finally, on Sunday, the Merchant Tap House hosts DJ Postal for 19 Plus Industry Night for free. Beats start at 10 p.m. Have a concert you'd like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Hey, I'm Ellie MacArthur, a CFRC intern from Queen's Department of History, and it's time for our events calendar for this week. On Monday, Time Out Bar and Bistro has a lovely bingo night beginning at 7 p.m., which is free to play. While the location is still being determined, Gender Diverse Song Circle takes place from 5:30 to 8 p.m. This is an all-ages event, and for more information, go to The Yellow House, Beyond the Binary Kingston, or Trans Family Kingston. Tuesday, September 30th is National Truth and Reconciliation Day. From 1 to 5:30 p.m., gather at Confederation Park for a day of reflection, learning, and connecting. The event includes community booths and activities, an Indigenous market, and community performances. Walk for Truth and Reconciliation takes place at McBurney Park starting at 5 p.m. The 5th annual Every Child Matters Walk takes place at 10 a.m. at the Mohawks of the Bay Quinty Administration Building. Seven Drunken Nights, the story of Dubliners, comes to Kingston Grand Theatre at 7 p.m. Tickets can be purchased at the door or on the Grand's website for $70. The Screening Room plays Sugarcane, a documentary about the truths of the residential school system. You can register for admission on the Screening Room's website. Every Wednesday at the Mansion is karaoke. With no cover, grab your friends and head over at 9 p.m. with a song in mind. Time Out Bistro Bar also hosts karaoke at 9 p.m. Walk Right Back, The Everly Brothers Story, hits the Kingston Grand Theatre this Wednesday at 7 p.m. Tickets can be purchased on the Kingston Grand Theatre website. The Kingston Grand Theatre presents Howie Mandel for the first show of the season at 7:30 p.m. Tickets can be purchased on the Grand's website from $70 to $90. The Grad Club hosts open stage drag shows on the first Wednesday of the month from 8 to 10:30 p.m. There is a $5 cover. On Thursday, catch Original Thursdays with Rob Lutz and the History of Music Workshop at the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. Reservations are preferred and can be booked by calling or emailing the inn. At Kingston City Hall, catch Heritage Hour, the story of the spire with Ellie Deer. This takes place for free from noon to 1 p.m. And the Kingston Grand Theatre presents This is the Story of the Child Ruled by Fear at 7:30 for $30. Tickets can be purchased at the doors or online through the Grand's website. Tierna and Og holds karaoke from 9 p.m. to midnight. And on Friday, the Historical Costume Ball Drag Show Fashion Pageant Spectacular is a No Minors event that takes place from 6:30 to 10 p.m. at Grant Hall. While the early cruise for The Life of a Showgirl is sold out, the late cruise from 8 to 10 p.m. is not. Get your tickets through Kingston 1000 Islands Cruises for $30. French Hot Cuisine, Kingston's Baroque Consort's first concert of the season, takes place at St. James Anglican Church from 4:15 to 7 p.m. Physical tickets can be purchased at Novel Idea and range in price from $10 to $25. The Kingston Art Tour is back on October 4th and 5th, with more than a dozen studios and venues across the region opening their doors to showcase local artists, live performances, workshops, and music. A celebration of creativity for all ages. On Saturday, visit the Memorial Center Farmers Market from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and find a range of local crafts and locally sourced agriculture. There are often lawn games, music, and free activities, making it the perfect place for any age group. This market is also a great opportunity to engage with the Kingston community. The market at Wolf Island Commons runs every Saturday until October 11th from 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. across the street from the hotel at the waterfront. Vibrant Voices is a community song circle event for 2S LGBTQIA+ community and allies and is open to teens and adults. The event takes place at the Kingston Frontenac Public Library Central Branch from 1 to 3 p.m. La Vida Bistro Bar and Social hosts stand-up comedy show in Kingston Saturday, as seen on City TV and CBC. This night of laughter begins at 8 p.m. and tickets are $20 and found through Kingston. Interwoven, a workshop in story, kinship, and land, is a multidisciplinary Indigenous performance at Little Cataraqui Creek Conservation Area. This free event showcases Dave Moat sharing histories of the land, taking place from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Then, on Sunday, the second part of Interwoven, taking place from 3 to 4 p.m., is an opportunity to try food and drink curated by an Indigenous chef. Following will be the performance from 4 to 5:30. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
The second annual Kingston Art Tour returns October 4th to 5th, 2025, showcasing a vibrant mix of local talent from preteens to retiring artists. Studios, cafes, and community spaces across Kingston and the surrounding area will open their doors, featuring painters, sculptors, filmmakers, textile artists, doll makers, and photographers. Highlights include the final showing of acclaimed painter Robin Laws Field, live portrait painting sessions, martial arts and swordplay demonstrations, youth theater, hands-on workshops, and an all-day music jam. With more than a dozen venues spanning Kingston, Berryfield, Glen Burnie, Sydenham, and Battersea, the self-guided tour invites the public to explore art in every form while celebrating the creative spirit of the region. For more information, go to kingstonarttour.com, at Kingston Art Tour 2025 on Instagram, or joangervais.com, joannegervais.com.
Your Queens Gaels are on the road on October 4th to take on the Guelph Griffins. A win for the Gaels punches their ticket to the OUA playoffs. A loss for the Griffins could spell the end of a once-promising season. Will it be the surging Gaels or the struggling Griffins? Anything can happen on game day, so you don't want to miss out. Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca at 12:45 p.m. for the Grad Club pregame show ahead of the scheduled 1 o'clock kickoff.
What's going on? What are you doing? Tanya Dahaskigo, then on the Wadahun Sadache, Ungahuan, and Hadiwa Nodas, Nene Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawar Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 284. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with Aviva Gutman. Aviva is an educator and author based in the UK and has published a really important recent book that looks at the realities of Western European collusion with the Israeli Security Service in the context of repression against Palestinian activists in the 1970s. Aviva's work, I think, is an important historical window into collaboration between state intelligence agencies, particularly looking at the governments of France and Germany and also the UK in the context of the targeting and killing of Palestinian activists in Europe, Western Europe, particularly in the 1970s and into the 1980s. This is a really meticulously documented and researched book that I think is an important work to consider at this time. This is my conversation with historian Aviva Gutman for Free City Radio. Aviva, your research work seems to point to a really important trajectory between the present and the past in terms of Western European security agencies working deeply with the intelligence agencies of the Israeli state for a particular means, which is repressing Palestinian organizations working in diaspora contexts in Europe. And I came across your work and I felt it was really important to try to create a little bit of a through line between the present and the past. I think that there can be some narratives that sort of adopt this discourse that present the last few years as an anomaly and as something that is really just sort of emerging. But there's a whole historical context and your work points to that. Most importantly, I think there are some parallels between the sort of apparatus of repression that you address with other elements that are concerning also the domestic repression of activists. I mean, in the UK, there's been a lot of important revealings of the ways that climate justice activists were facing the infiltration by state agents indirectly into the group, including in romantic relationships. The late scholar Aziz Chaudhry addressed some of these points in Activists in the Surveillance State. Thanks so much to you, Aviva, for taking a bit of time to talk about your work. Maybe you could just first start with an introduction about yourself, and then just speak about why you embarked on this research and why you feel it's critical and important at this time and in this context.
I kind of gotten interested at first through terrorism. I think what you mentioned, you know, that it's not a new phenomenon. I think you're right. We kind of look back in history and see how a lot of the developments have actually started way before, let's say, 9/11. And I was starting to look at the reaction of European governments to this new, this what they perceived as new threats of Palestinians using the tactic of, you know, terrorism or, as you also mentioned, it's not just limited to them. It's limited also to all kind of left-wing activism. So it's I'm looking at the reaction of the government to these kind of perceived threats and especially the level of international cooperation. So I'm not looking at what happened on the national level, but I'm really looking at how did this change the international relations of the secret state? How did intelligence agencies realize, okay, we have to... we will not be able to address that issue by ourselves. We need to have a learning process. We don't really understand these groups, really. We want to multiply our forces by sharing intelligence, by meeting up, by having shared and combined training sessions. And that this is how that this is what we looked at also from a democratic oversight perspective. You know, these intelligence agencies, they were working together on a completely informal level. And they have resisted any type of oversight up until today. I mean, the European Union has tried to create a more formalized intelligence sharing framework. And the intelligence agency says, no, we want to be able to share intelligence with the Israelis so that nobody knows about that. If it was a formal entity, then that might not be possible. We want to be able to keep things secret from Arab countries, for instance. We want to not have... We don't want the public to know what kind of information that we are sharing and how much information is being shared about people. And the thing here, again, is a parallel between the 70s and today. The amount of data that was shared in the 70s is staggering. We didn't have computers at the time to the same level that we do have today. And can only imagine today, it must be enormous. That was my original frame of research. And then I started looking at, okay, intelligence agencies, they have a link to one another. They have direct connections. They're almost having their own foreign policy, it seems. And then I was linking that to what the Israelis were doing, right? Assassinating Palestinians in Europe if they had any known or believed connection to the Munich Olympics attack or if they were believed to prepare future attacks. And so then I was genuinely intrigued by the question of, did the European intelligence agencies change their behavior towards Mossad and Shin Bet, the two main Israeli intelligence agencies, when they knew that the information that they would be sharing with Israelis could and would be used for their assassination campaign? And I was very surprised that nothing had changed whatsoever. They continued. I think one insight is one of my favorites, if you want, of my book, is that it led to kind of an absurd situation where the murderers were being updated about their own murder investigation. Namely, after every assassination, the different intelligence agencies say assassination happened in Paris. So the French DST would share a police report about all the findings that we currently know about this assassination with the whole group of intelligence agencies to which Mossad was participating. So for Mossad, this was important on two ways. One, of course, it learned how to be more careful next time. For instance, there was a bystander who was able to write down the license plate of the vehicle that was used to escape after the assassination. So they probably learned, you know, they have to be more careful with this. But I think on a more important level, the French were signaling to Mossad that they would look the other way, you know, by sending the investigation of the assassination that has been committed by Mossad. They're basically saying, we will not look too deep into this affair. You may go on with what you're doing. We will, it's like a don't ask, don't tell, but it signals a certain tacit support, I would say.
This underlines a lot of the deep structural issues around the gap between discourse and action on the level of state agencies. So Western labeled discourse around due process and you know, the rule of law, etc., which, I mean, since October 2023 has really been brought into question because of the scale of injustice taking place in Palestine today. However, I think that it's always important to think about things in a trajectory and not in isolation. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that sort of gap between the sort of public-facing discourse of you know, Western European countries in this context and action, and how your research speaks to that.
I think precisely because these intelligence exchanges could be kept entirely secret, at least until a historian comes and digs these documents out, that secrecy allowed these covert relations between the West and Israel to be maintained. And absolutely, you know, towards the end of this assassination campaign, I mean, let's say it came to an abrupt end when Mossad thought that they had killed one of the assumed, you know, leaders of, not one of the leaders of Black September organization. And in fact, they had killed a cleaner and a Moroccan cleaner and waiter who lived in Norway, had actually a wife that was pregnant 7 months. He just happened to look very closely, very similarly to Ali Hassan Salameh. In any case, this sparked international crisis. The Norwegians were outraged. They had not, they said they didn't know about these assassinations. Even, you know, it was a internationally, like, the relations had bittered and there was a outrage against Israel. But I really looked at the third part of my book, really looked at exchanges among the intelligence agencies, and it was absolutely nothing had changed. So you had this official level condemnation and secret level cooperation, business as usual. Even the police reports after assassinations were continuing to be shared with Mossad. So even on these specific cases, it was not just about Palestinians more broadly, even in specific cases where Mossad was involved, they continued sharing intelligence.
So I think for people hearing this, some people will be familiar with the context that you're talking about. Some people will not. So maybe you could just sort of go back and give us a bit of a picture of the time that you're talking about, and also why knowing about this period is important in the present context.
Okay. So let's have a delve into the 1970s and look at a watershed moment for international history, which is the Munich Olympics in 1972. It was meant to be a heitere Sommerfestspiele, as they say in German. It was meant to be a cheerful atmosphere in Munich. The German government on purpose had a very light security footprint. Also noteworthy is that the Palestinians have asked the Olympics committee to participate in the Olympics, and they were denied access to it. They said, well, you're not the country, so no, you're not joining. And that is said has given kind of the impetus for the Palestinians saying, well, we will join whether you want us or not. And they organized an attack. And so what happened is that a Palestinian group called Black September Organization had climbed up the fence. As I said, the security was very light there, and entered the Olympics and the Israeli Olympics team compound and took, I think, 11 hostages. And what happened is that the German government wanted to lure them into a trap, and said, yes, we will fly you out to Egypt and continue negotiations. But in fact, they had planned a rescue operation to free the hostages. And at that point, it went terribly foul. And all the hostages, so all the Israeli athletes, were killed. And everybody except for three Palestinians had survived. Everybody except for three Palestinians died as well. So only three had of the perpetrators had survived. And that a particularity of this event is that the world was watching. You know, the television had been recently been invented and had made its way into the household of people. So the world was watching the Olympics. And as the Palestinians carried out the hostage taking, the world was watching as well. There was, again, I think that was a shock for the Israelis in all genuinity. It was the pride of their athletes. They were going back to Germany after a long history, a very problematic history, obviously, post-war history also between Israel and Germany as West Germany as states. And the Israeli government said, well, we want revenge for that, what happened. And they knew that if they were to ask for extradition requests, the Arab countries would simply refuse. So they were saying, well, we will take justice in our own hands, you know. And so the Israeli leadership, Golda Meir in person, decided to initiate an assassination campaign. And first they wanted to find out who was this Black September organization. It was not well known at the time who they were. They wanted to find out who had allegedly been planning this Munich Olympics attack, and they wanted to hunt and kill everybody involved. And I mean, here we have parallels to today's 7th of October attack. There's a comparable unit. Today it's called the Neely unit, that also is in charge of finding out who was likely responsible and involved in the attack. And these people had also today are hunted down and killed in actually a very similar way than this happened in the 1970s. So this assassination campaign is today known as Operation Wrath of God. And what my book reveals for the first time is that the Israelis didn't do it alone. The Europeans were providing intelligence that helped locate the Palestinians that were on a target list, help find out their routines, help find out their address simply, or what they were doing, and helped with the planning of the this assassination campaign. And as I hinted at earlier, it helped with signaling to Mossad that they will be that this will be tolerated from a European perspective.
A lot can be drawn from what you've shared. One point I think that could be interesting to talk about is sort of how an event like this changes the political parameters of what is understood as possible in the context of the Israeli state. And I think like drawing an understanding from that time to the present, where we've seen a move towards genocidal policies, which is a political decision that happened. And that decision doesn't take place in a vacuum. There's a series of events that have led to there being an understanding that on some political level, the Israeli state could continue to maintain relations with Western countries despite these things happening. Of course, I think it's always important to underline that these types of activities aren't exclusive to the Israeli state. There's a long history of targeted political assassinations tied to the French government, to the British government in terms of anti-colonial uprisings in Kenya, in the context of British occupation, or in India, or North Africa in the context of France. And obviously that's always important to underline, but we are talking about the Mossad and Western Europe state institutions. Sort of understanding this context, I think, and how it sort of plays a political role in the staging of now is probably important.
If you want to draw some more parallels between the 7th of October and the Munich Olympics in 72, I think both of them, as you say, change the perception of what is possible, from the Israeli side, this was perceived as a legitimate reaction. I mean, Golda Meir was actually more like replying to requests from the Israeli society to do something to retribute these athletes who have been killed, to avenge them in a way. There was even an attempt, somebody right after the Munich Olympics, an Israeli, thought that the government was not doing enough and actually tried to smuggle weapons himself to Europe to try to, plan an attack somewhat against Palestinians. And then I think the Israeli government was kind of reassuring him, like, no, we are taking care of that. But what I'm saying with that is that there was a hunger for, and there was a need to address this perceived injustice of the of what happened in Munich.
Political landscapes change in relation to such events, and what's deemed as permissible also changes in terms of like diplomatic relations and political possibilities. And so I was thinking about your research work in relation to how the political landscape changed after that event, and then also how there's a through line in relation to the work of intelligence agencies and information sharing from then until now. Of course, like, it's important to underline, you know, projects like the Five Eyes, I think, you know, and learn more about institutions like that. I guess just to sort of end, could you just say the name of the book and also just share a bit as a historian why this, why you took on this project? It's obviously a huge effort that I'm sure took many years. Why was this important for you to share now?
The book is called Operation Wrath of God, The Secret History of European Intelligence and Mossad's Assassination Campaign. Why is it important that I was there? I think it does shed light on, as you say, on a history that helps explaining current events as well. I think it shows to a certain degree an event, it sheds light on an event of the Munich Olympics attack in a similar way that the 7th of October has changed Israeli society forever, has impacted international relations, but it also sheds light on a secret level that is not often discussed. And that is equally important because this is oftentimes, you know, where the realpolitik of international relations does happen, and therefore should be discussed as well and have a you know, should open up further reflections that are also relevant for today. You know, with whom are we currently sharing intelligence? Should we have a national debate about what kind of information is being shared with whom? Should there be a law that regulates intelligence agencies? Should they be free? And should there be criteria for only, you know, sharing intelligence with democracies? But then where do you draw the line? So these are difficult discussions, but I do believe that the book kind of opens as well the doors to enter these debates and to think more about it.
Aviva, thank you so much. And I think, you know, a lot of what you shared is also important for people who are hearing this in the Canadian context to think about how intelligence agencies have acted in a very repressive way towards Indigenous groups, for example, in Canada. So there's a lot of connections to be made and understanding that can be drawn from the specific example that you look into, but as taking place globally. So thank you so much for the conversation today.
My pleasure.
That was a conversation with historian and author Aviva Gutman, author of Operation Wrath of God, The Secret History of European Intelligence and Mossad's Assassination Campaign. That is out through Cambridge University Press in the UK. Thanks so much to Aviva for being on the program today. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.